Welcome back, listeners, to Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Today, it is our joy to be joined by Dr. Eileen Davila. Dr. Eileen Davila is the Medical Officer of Health for the City of Toronto. In this position, she leads Toronto Public Health, the largest local public health agency in Canada, which offers various programs and services to the city's more than 3 million residents. Dr. Davila received her Doctor of Medicine and Master's of Health Science degree in health promotion from the University of Toronto. Additionally, she holds an MBA from the Schulich School of Business at York University. She is also an adjunct professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dr. Davila has actively contributed to various fields of scientific research by authoring, publishing, and presenting studies on the variety of subjects. Her influential research covers vital areas such as urban health, emergency readiness, disease control, and policy development. In the fight against COVID-19, Dr. Davila guided Toronto's largest vaccination campaign. Her unwavering commitment to equipping the public with knowledge and her pivotal role in pandemic response has been recognized globally. Dr. Eileen Davila, welcome to Built to Lead.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Let's just get right into it. The first question I wanted to start by asking you, in your opinion, what does rebel mean to you?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I thought about this quite a bit, especially as a medical practitioner. And, in the context of a profession like medicine, you know, the term rebel isn't generally considered a good thing, right? There are, for example, within the medical practice, what are called standards of practice that we are meant as a profession to uphold. And so when you think about the concept of a term rebel in a profession where there are standards that must be adhered to and upheld, generally the concept of rebel isn't one that has positive connotations. I also happen to work in a large organization. Mubin, you talked about Toronto Public Health, right? Toronto's largest local public health agency. And in the context of a large organization, not surprisingly, there are often policies and procedures that are meant to actually support the good functioning of that organization. And in that context, again, rebel doesn't generally take on, you know, a positive meaning or context. But when I think about this concept, I think it's not just about, what is the term rebel, but what is the purpose of the rebelliousness, right? What's the ultimate objective of being a rebel or having a rebellious approach? And I think in the context of public health, if the purpose that we're talking about is advancing the objectives of public health, which means improving the health status of the population we're serving, reducing inequities in the health status of those people that we serve, and as well, making sure that we're prepared for and able to respond effectively to outbreaks and public health emergencies. If we're talking about rebelliousness or being a rebel in that context, and with those purposes in mind, well, I think it takes on different meaning. And I think what that looks like is sort of being open to the possibility that whatever the accepted wisdom is, or whatever the accepted thinking is, might not be right, right? So that to me is where we fundamentally get at the meaning of rebel. And not always easy when you come from a strong discipline like medicine and do so and you work in a context of a large organization.
Yeah, I love how you talked about being a good rebel and it's all about that purpose. And because if we look at a rebel, as you said, sometimes it's not good. And sometimes it could be good. And that's all dependent on the purpose of the individual. So that even brings us to our topic today, which is perspective. And Francisco Gino describes perspective as suspending your current reality. In other words, putting yourself on hold and to be able to see beyond your own perspective and embracing open-mindedness. When you can shift your perspective, you're able to think more clearly and take into consideration the expertise of and the viewpoints of others, and see new possibilities to problems when making decisions. Perspective is crucial for leaders. As leaders, we're constantly pivoting, we're constantly expanding, and we should be constantly learning from our own mistakes and decisions to excel. And I'm excited to explore this topic with one of Toronto's and Canada's top decision makers.
Indeed. We are honored to have yet another special guest join us today. But we wanted to do this interview a little differently from the rest to make the most of this opportunity being with Dr. Davila. Dr. Davila has had an extraordinary career trajectory that led her to leading Toronto's response to COVID-19 pandemic and now sharing her experiences with learners such as Matthew and myself. Through this episode, we hope to get to know Dr. Davila up close and personal and hear her thoughts about a Forbes article on the importance of understanding others' perspectives as a leadership skill. Dr. Davila, it's a pleasure to have you, and we wanted to start off by kind of getting the foundational aspect of your career. So would you be able to tell us your career journey that led you to becoming the Medical Officer of Health for the City of Toronto?
Yeah, very happy to share. And you know what's really interesting about this is that when I think about my journey to becoming a public health physician and ultimately landing in this position, the Medical Officer of Health for the City of Toronto, it actually starts in, I think, rebellion, which I think is kind of interesting, given your opening question. And what do I mean by that? I'm the daughter of two physicians. And my grandfather before me was a physician, and so are a series of aunts and uncles and cousins. I come from a largely medical family. If you weren't a physician, you were a lawyer. These were kind of the two professional options that were really at the forefront in my family. And the interesting thing is that as I finished high school, I wasn't totally convinced that I wanted to pursue a medical career. My grandmother wanted me to. She's like, you know, your parents are both physicians. Why wouldn't you just become a physician? That's kind of the natural and right thing to do. But I wasn't totally convinced by that. I hadn't totally thrown it away, but I was exploring all kinds of options. So I really was veering away from medicine, frankly, because I had seen two incredible people, probably two of the people I admire the most in this world, my parents, go through a medical career. I saw its rewards for sure, and I saw the challenges associated with it as well. So, you know, I thought that there were other opportunities that were worthy of exploration. So I actually never really thought about a career in medicine in that really sort of I've wanted to be a doctor ever since I was 4 years old kind of thing. That wasn't my story at all. In fact, I thought I was going to do something along the lines of, you know, United Nations work. These were the kinds of things that I found interesting. And I was fortunate enough to land an internship in the context of a UN organization, a United Nations organization. And that was what opened up my eyes. This is after completing an undergraduate degree, opened up my eyes to the world of international or community health. And I loved what I was doing. I was working in a unit that actually supported the development of pharmaceutical industries in countries that didn't actually have access to basic pharmaceutical products. And so it was this really neat combination of projects that were actually aimed at supporting communities to become increasingly self-sufficient. It had elements of politics, there were elements of business, there were clear elements of health. And so that's what opened my eyes to the possibility of pursuing public health studies. And it was in the course of doing more public health studies and more opportunities with the United Nations system that led me to believe that, okay, I think I could actually do this. And I think I could do this with a medical lens. So I finally did apply to medical school and went through the public health and preventive medicine residency, started my career in local public health at Peel Public Health, just to the west of Toronto. And then for the last almost 7 years, it's been my honor and privilege to serve as Medical Officer of Health for the City of Toronto, the city I call home. So incredibly, incredibly meaningful for me to be able to serve my community with my skill set, along with the team, the remarkable team I work with, working towards making this the healthiest city possible. This is, you know, it's a dream job. How else can I describe it?
That's amazing. And I really appreciate you sharing the beginnings. You know, it's we've had a couple of guests who have also been clinicians, but they've had a different story where it's like, you know, their parents did not have that clinician background. And so to them, it felt as though it was a natural next step to then grow into the medical community and be a part of it. But also, they would only be exposed to what they would enter into, versus you come from a perspective where you kind of have an idea of the stresses that come with the position. You know, there's a certain baggage that, you know, clinicians do carry, a higher responsibility that clinicians carry. And the fact that you saw that from an outside lens, did something different, but then knew your positioning in the field after that, really stands out. In Rebel Talent, Gino states in the perspective chapter that when we are faced with extreme stress, it is helpful to take a step back. When we think of what we could do, our thinking becomes much broader. We imagine, explore more possibilities before we make a final decision. Gino suggests shifting the mindset from what should I do, which is restrictive in nature, to a more flexible mindset of what could I do. I know you touched upon this earlier, but Dr. Davila, how do you deal with stress professionally? And does Gino's suggestion resonate with you?
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about Francesca Gino's suggestion, it certainly does resonate. There's no question. It sounds a lot, you described it, I think, as a flexible mindset. Others describe it as a growth mindset, you know, going from what should I do to what could I do. And this is challenging in medicine. As I mentioned at the outset, medicine has a lot of standards of practice to which we are held accountable. And that's a lot about what should I do in this set of circumstances. Our medical training is all about assessing the situation and figuring out, okay, in this set of circumstances, right, in its whole totality, what should I do? But you're right. I think when we saw a situation like COVID-19, brand new virus, nobody had ever seen this virus before, right? Completely new to us. The notion of what should I do kind of goes out the window because there is no playbook, right? Not a specific COVID-19 playbook. There are infectious disease playbooks. There are, you know, pandemic playbooks. There are general principles, but it is really all about what could I do. So I do really appreciate that mindset and this notion of maintaining that flexibility, particularly in stressful situations. I think, though, when I'm being really honest about it, as I said, as a physician who comes from a very strong, you know, training and background on standards of practice, I don't know that that's my natural approach. It's not the first place my mind goes. I will often go first, quite candidly, to what should I do. But I find that for me, rather than going through the process in my own head to get to what could I do, the way I get there is by talking to lots of other people, right? Because by definition, I'm getting other perspectives. And in getting other perspectives, you very quickly, I think, get to the what could I do. So for me, I find that the way I get to a more flexible, open mindset is by talking to other people. I think, and that's why it's really important to my mind in positions like mine and in, you know, positions where you are actually dealing with a great deal of complexity and at a rapid pace, it's really important to have a network of people that you trust who hail from all kinds of backgrounds and who come from different philosophical points of view. And so I think when you have that kind of trusted network, people that you can speak with who challenge your thinking and who bring a different perspective, it's in speaking to them that you naturally get to a what could I do place in your mind and in your thinking.
No, that's important. And because it is not easy, Dr. Davila, when we look at it to say, how do we go from what should I do to what could I do? And I love how you talked about having that network of people that you can kind of rely on, because you're right. You do need to ask those questions. You do need to make sure that we're perspective seeking. And you talked about medicine being a challenge, and even going to COVID-19, that's even a major challenge. As you talked about, there was no playbook. So in like team setting, I like to play sports as well. Communication is always key. So when I'm playing basketball, for some reason, I don't like when it's quiet. Like I always have to be communicating, let people know, okay, we have this defensive lapse here, et cetera, because I think that helps the team move forward, even if we don't know what's approaching us, as long as we're communicating going forward. And just even in your bio, we've seen that you led one of the largest vaccination campaign in Toronto's history during COVID-19. So first of all, thank you for the work that you've done, because that was really an unprecedented time. And as we talked about stress, I'm sure it was very stressful for you, for the city, just for the world overall. And we also saw how varying perspectives there was on the virus, and particularly the vaccines, while the policies and some of the guidelines were constantly changing, even on a global scale. What rebel moves or decisions did you make while leading Toronto's vaccination response? And maybe where did you push the boundaries from what should be done to what could be done?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. And there are all kinds of things that we had to push and advance and you know, think about differently or bring different thinking to as part of dealing with a novel virus and as part of undertaking the largest vaccination campaign in the history of the world. Clearly, we were responsible for the city, but writ large, this was the largest vaccination campaign in the history of the world, and for us in Toronto, largest vaccination campaign in the history of the city. You know, one of the situations that comes to mind is thinking about meeting patients where they're at and making sure that decision makers appreciate that while they have a particular perspective on how things should be run, there's that word again, should be, for others, that may not be the case. So what I think is good for me, what I think is a good vaccination experience, may not actually line up with what others think is a good vaccination experience. And you're probably wondering, what is she talking about? So I'm going to explain a little bit about what I'm talking about. You know, in the vaccination campaign, particularly early on in the vaccination campaign, there were all kinds of challenges around supply. You know, there was a limited supply of vaccines made available and a lot of demand at the outset. So one of the challenges was making sure that the vaccine was getting to the places where it could provide the greatest benefit to the populations for whom it would be the provide the greatest benefit, and to do so in a timely fashion, right? You want to get the highest risk people vaccinated as quickly as possible. And as the campaign and the vaccination efforts were unfolding, it became clear that there were certain neighborhoods where vaccine wasn't being taken up as much, but where frankly there was a lot of illness, a lot of impact of COVID-19. And so one of the things that I think we all had to challenge ourselves around was there is a vision of what constitutes a good vaccination clinic. Traditional pandemic playbooks talk about setting up things like mass immunization clinics or fixed immunization clinics, which are incredibly efficient in terms of getting a lot of people vaccinated in a short period of time. But if you're trying to get to other neighborhoods where, frankly, we were seeing the uptake wasn't as high, you had to, you know, change and break that model. So one of the things that clearly needed to be done was to bring vaccines closer rather than having people come to the vaccines, which technically is a very efficient model. Sometimes you need to be slightly less efficient by having a series of smaller vaccination clinics, but closer to people, right? So that they're actually taking up the vaccine. And I remember talking to some of our decision makers as some of the clinics were set up in communities in and around the city, the north and west parts of the city, the East, Scarborough in particular, lots of challenges with getting people interested in taking up the vaccine. So it needed to be brought closer to them with people who were from the community helping to deliver the vaccine. And the traditional model, I think, as some of those clinics were set up, some of our decision makers were noticing that there were big lineups outside some of these new mobile clinics that were set up. And this was considered, you know, that's considered bad service for many people who are in the decision maker seats in government, whether it's at the local, provincial, or even the federal level. Long lineups doesn't look like a good thing. It's kind of synonymous with bad service. But it's interesting. We found in talking to people on the streets, in the communities, that sometimes the long lineups were a sign of demand for the service. And in a community where there was some reluctance around the vaccine, actually knowing that your neighbors were lining up to get that vaccine and having the lineup create opportunities for conversation actually helped drive vaccination uptake. As imperfect as it was, these things actually do have positive aspects. So this was a tough conversation to have with decision makers who, you know, really didn't like the notion of lineups. And, you know, at some of the senior tables within the city, we had to have a tough conversation around, look, maybe that doesn't work for you in the kind of clinic that you're wanting to visit. And maybe that's not the way you want to receive your healthcare. But we're actually hearing from others that this is how they want to receive their healthcare. So let's, you know, facilitate their ability to get healthcare, their service in the way they want to receive it, in a way that's meaningful to them, rather than focus on those services solely with our perspective, our point of view, our conception of what constitutes good service or not good service. So that's one example. And Matthew, Mabeen, if you have all day, I've got a list.
No, we really appreciate that. You know, what really, there's one thing that really stands out that I just wanted to call out. Actually, there's two. Number one is, I would like to say that where I live current time, and just by me describing it, you might kind of think of a name, is one of the most culturally diverse neighborhoods in Toronto. I live within East and North York, and so that area, it's completely beautiful, and I'd like to say it's like the microcosm of the world. There's so many different cultures, so many different languages being spoken in just one specific region, that it's amazing. One thing that I saw during the pandemic, during the COVID-19 vaccination campaigns, that I really appreciated, was that a lot of community leaders were getting involved rather than those who were working for Toronto Public Health, because they were the voice of the community, and they stepped up in partnership with Toronto Public Health to be the voice of reason of why this is important. And I think you kind of described, you know, sometimes lines are a good thing because it shows a form of optics. It shows a way of importance that, you know, there's a reason behind why this vaccination, there's an uptake of it and there's a demand for it. And in a time of such high uncertainty and so much frustration, it's hard to sometimes think clearly, right? It's like, you know, because no one really knows what's right and what's wrong. We really don't know, right? But what we do know is the efficacy of a vaccine, of what it could do if there was an uptake. I was going to do another question comment, but I'll stick on this one. How did you navigate the competing perspectives of, you know, those saying, you know, the right, the wrong? And how did you navigate the power dynamics that, you know, you had to deal with at that time between the local, provincial, and national levels? I know this might be a big question, so I'll let you kind of take it the way you'd like. But how was it kind of navigating that complexity in that time being?
You know, that it's a great question, Mabeen. And as I think about it, you know, you're talking about this question in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic and the response that was required. No question, that was, you know, the most significant public health emergency of the last 100 years. Novel virus. So there was a lot of learning on the fly, absolutely. And it was fraught with all kinds of challenge, right? Every new situation, think about it, anything that you've done in your life, right? When it's new to you, You've never done it before, right? I think we can all expect that it won't be done perfectly, but it can be done with a learning sort of approach, a certain, I would like to think, humility around, look, we don't know everything. We're going to apply some good, solid principles, constantly observe and keep changing, right? So there's no question. COVID-19 was a unique set of circumstances. And, you know, the challenge of navigating competing perspectives in that environment with all the scrutiny and with all the, you know, shared anxiety, right, around what this virus meant for us, was especially challenging. But the notion of navigating competing priorities and competing perspectives and power dynamics is candidly, that's every day in public health practice, right? So when we talk about, right, we're talking about public health practice, which is all about improving the health status, reducing inequities in that health status, and preparing for and responding effectively to outbreaks and emergencies, right? This is done at a population level, right, with a prevention first focus all the time. And ultimately, you know, when we're talking about improving health status of a population, and we're talking about reducing inequities in health status, this is about the social determinants of health, right? The conditions within which people live, work, and play. And it's also significantly around creating environments that actually allow people to adopt the healthiest possible behaviors as a default, right? So fundamentally, it's about changing behaviors and preventing disease and prolonging life and promoting health through, you know, a combination of art and science. So if I put all that together, right, navigating competing perspectives, power dynamics, this is part and parcel of everyday public health practice. So that's why when I think about public health practice and what it is that we do, one way to characterize it is about, yes, preventing disease, yes, about promoting health, but in so doing by changing what's acceptable, right? Changing what's socially acceptable. So think about that for a moment. That is all about competing, you know, perspectives and power dynamics. Think about how 100 years ago, it was acceptable. It was considered, you know, just the way things are for people to lose at least one child before the age of 5 in this country. Right? Go and visit an old cemetery anywhere in and around this city, like an old established cemetery. And unfortunately, what you will see are a series of gravestones, you know, tens, if not hundreds, where young infants were laid to rest by their parents, right? Early 1900s, late 1800s. Not that long ago, when you think about our history, right? A little over 100 years ago. Commonplace for people to lose at least one child before that child had the opportunity to reach 5 years of age. Because infectious diseases were so prevalent. Access to clean water was a challenge. And unfortunately, in many parts of the world, this is still the case.
For sure.
But why are we, you know, that's no longer commonplace. We don't accept that here anymore as okay. That's not just the way it is, right? Because we know there are measures and interventions that can be taken to actually reduce that risk, right? To prevent disease, to promote health, and to prolong that life. Clean water, antibiotics, vaccines against you know, vaccine preventable diseases. These are the kinds of things that have actually made those circumstances no longer socially acceptable. And that's the history of public health, right? That's what we do. Think about tobacco. You know, when I was a kid growing up in this city, it was pretty routine to run into smoking in public places, everywhere, restaurants, airplanes, offices, cars, you name it. That was just part of the way our environment was. You know, the majority of adults smoked on a daily basis. But over time, through the concerted efforts of public health and many other partners, right, we have changed that. That is no longer considered acceptable because we know how harmful that is. We brought the science to bear. And, you know, I can assure you that was not a simple challenge. It required, there were, what was your terminology? Competing
yeah,
perspectives.
You're right.
There were absolutely competing perspectives, you know, when it came
yeah.
to tobacco legislation and controls to limit exposure, particularly to secondhand smoke. And there were definitely power dynamics engaged, right? But again, that's the story of public health, right? That's the joy and the day-to-day work of public health is actually absolutely navigating those competing perspectives and those power dynamics in a way that actually advances health status and reduces inequities in health status.
Two quick things. Change is a constant. From this is what I'm learning from as you speak. Change is a constant. And number two, history repeats itself, but in today's context, how will you respond to it?
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And that's not just about public health, right? I think that's about pretty much every human endeavor that there is out mm-hmm. there.
Absolutely.
And even as you talk about the history of public health, it kind of reminds me of one of the TED Talks you did do. You did talk about changing the story. So it is possible to change the story. And by doing that, we have to change our thinking, and then we go into changing our actions. So really going back to that growth mindset, for even me, myself, changing the thinking is pretty key, because even going back to that long line, the long line analogy that you were talking about, to be honest, I probably would have been one of those decision makers because I don't like long lines whatsoever. So I would have said, nah, this is not a good idea, but it's sign of demand, as we talked about. And that perspective does change. So even looking at maybe the opportunities that long lines have. So we talked about it shows interest, but at the same time, maybe this is an opportunity to talk to the public. We have public health officials that can speak with individuals in the line. So we build those relationships, which I think is key.
For sure. For sure. And Matthew, I think even more important than public health officials in those lines were the conversations that were happening amongst community members themselves, right? That's where the real power was. Of course, we wanted to make sure, we made sure that there was information out there, you know, evidence-informed information. You know, in today's world, it is very easy to be constantly bombarded with information of, you know, and I'm putting it mildly, varying quality, right? There's misinformation and there's outright disinformation out there. So it becomes really important to have, you know, proper evidence-informed information out there. But just as important as the information is who's delivering it. Are they trusted, right? It could be the best information in the world. But if it's not coming from a trusted source, it's not going to get the kind of impact that it needs to have, especially in
Absolutely.
A crisis type situation.
Thank you, Eileen, for that. And it really just goes to the point of that growth mindset again, continuous learning and making sure we're getting that information from the right sources. And even going back to some of Gino's work, she talked about the importance of leaders adopting a mindset of continuous learning, which is about presenting yourself each day at work with the question, what will I learn today? Rather than what will I achieve or what will I complete? She also suggested being mindful of the dangers of feeling too knowledgeable and experienced, calling it the curse of knowledge, which can close us off to different approaches and it limits our perspectives that may lead us to disregard the perspective of others. In your position as a medical officer of health at the City of Toronto, and as a public health servant, you are public facing during the good and the challenging times. So to just get a little bit personal, what did you learn from your time as a leader responding to this pandemic?
So, Matthew, you know, that may take a whole other podcast. That's right. There's a whole series here. But when I think about, what can I share, in the time that we have in front of us? What did I learn from my time in leading the COVID-19 response? For me, I recognize that I'm not good and my team is not good when we go too fast. So I guess a more positive way of phrasing that is to say that, if you want to go fast, right, sometimes you actually have to go slow. That to me was probably the biggest takeaway. And it's one that I try to incorporate every single day. That if I want to go fast, if I want to see change, if I want to get to those objectives, as much as the urge is to, do it all and do it quickly, the real strength, the real lasting impact comes from actually slowing down, taking the time, getting the other perspectives, right? Reflecting on it, and then acting. And that's really tough in the context of a global emergency. Emotions are heightened, people are stressed out, and you're tired. Right? We were all tired. Those were long, long days of response. And it's in those circumstances where the temptation is to let's just do it quickly. You feel pressure to act and kind of act 5 minutes ago. But it you do realize, at least I've come to realize that it's exactly in those situations where you need to stop, breathe, right? Get together as a team. And talk it through, right? Go slow to go fast.
I love that because sometimes I have an internal conflict where it's like, society is moving so fast in today's time, that as and human nature is starting to kind of shift where it's like, instant gratification or seeing things much quicker, is starting to become a norm. People want to do things much quicker, get, rewards and acknowledgement much quicker. But what tends to happen in this notion is we tend to break more things getting to the destination and then having to revert back and then fixing those problems and then having to go that route again, where more time is actually consumed. It's so important from a leader like yourself to let us know as those who are emerging in the field or trying to find their footing that maybe you need to take a deep breath and acknowledge what's around you, and how you can make the most of it and how you can find the smaller nuances to make a difference rather than trying to go for that, ultimate gold star, which you probably will get if you put in your hard work, but in the longer, like it's in the longer trajectory.
Yeah, I think, it's often been said that patience is a virtue. That's true. That's true. Now that shouldn't it shouldn't stop us from wanting to achieve, right? Especially when the objectives we're talking about are things like improved health status and reduced inequities, right? I think we have to maintain that focus on what is it that we're trying to achieve, and can we consistently demonstrate that we're getting closer and closer to the goal, that the actions we're taking on are actually getting us there, right? And that's not easy either, right? Because sometimes it means recognizing that actually I thought this was going to work and it didn't. And it's not always easy to do that, especially if it's very public, right? That's a challenging thing to do. And it's especially challenging, I think, when there's a lot of hope and expectation. And there's a lot of anxiety, right? COVID-19 response being the classic example.
For sure.
But again, it has to be around, what are you focusing, what are you trying to achieve? How do we actually get there? And having that ability to recognize when our actions aren't necessarily panning out the way we want to, having the courage to be able to say, okay, that one didn't quite work out the way that we wanted to. And I think moving further to your point, as much as you want to take that breath and slow down in order to go fast, we're human. So sometimes you're going to forget to breathe and you're just going to go and do the, you know, the quick action. And I think, you know, being able to, you know, forgive yourself, right? To acknowledge the, you know, oops, I might've gone a little too fast there. You talked about breaking things along the way. If you've broken things, right? Acknowledge, apologize, and try to make up for it. And then keep going, right? What are we trying to achieve here? Remember, we're here to improve health status, to reduce health inequities, to make sure that we're ready and able to respond to outbreaks and emergencies. That's my constant mantra in public health, with a prevention focus at a population level. Everything has to be directed. That's our North Star. And if we can keep doing that in a respectful manner, then I know we're on a good path.
I think this is a great point in the conversation where we should take a break. Dr. Davila has definitely changed some of my perspectives on the management of COVID here in Toronto. In our next episode, Dr. Davila will continue her discussion on perspective management while we explore an article on why understanding different perspectives is a key to leadership development. We hope you'll continue to join us for part two of this very interesting conversation.
Thank you for listening today, and thank you for joining us on Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Built to Lead is created and hosted by Matthew Goldburn
and co-hosted by Mubin Lalani.
Built to Lead is a companion podcast to the Vernissage Health Dialogue Series at the Institute of Health Policy, Management, and Evaluation at the University of Toronto.
Tell us what you thought about this week's episode. You can find us on LinkedIn at Vernissage Health and on Instagram at Vernissage Health. You'll find both of these in the episode description. Today's episode was produced by
Dheeraj Thakur,
Matthew Goldburn, with music composed by Sindhu.
A special thanks to Wendy Nelson, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Health Policy, Management, and Evaluation. Until next time.